Wednesday show will be on case 75 in the Book of Serenity. Case 75 is entitled Ruiyan's Constant Principle. Introduction. Even as you call it thus, it's already changed. Where knowledge doesn't reach, avoid speaking of it. Here, is there any investigating or not? Case. Ruiyan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? Yanto said, moving. Ruiyan said, when moving, what then? Yanto said, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Ruiyan stood there thinking. Yanto said, if you agree, you are not yet free of sense and matter. If you don't agree, you'll be forever sunk in birth and death. Verse. The great round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body resting on nothing stands out unique and alive. I have a number of friends here at Rutgers who are in the facilities department. So they actually are responsible for maintaining the buildings, and they work very hard. You know, the people who clean this building know we do meditation, and they avoid coming in this area during our meditation periods. Isn't that nice? And they have to sometimes go out of the building and around to avoid bothering us. And sometimes there might be cleaning in this area, they have to go somewhere else and come back so as not to interrupt us. So they are really wonderful, wonderfully kind people, and we should all be grateful to them. Whenever I see them, I say hello, and I always thank them. You know, they work very hard, and I'm grateful. Nevertheless, there's things about Rutgers facilities which are really distinctively Rutgers, you know. So, for example, in my building, which is Murray Hall, when summer comes, they turn on the air conditioning, and they turn it on, and it's so cold that people are miserable all summer long. You know, people bring sweaters to work. And so, there's parts of our building that are literally uninhabitable in the summer because it's so cold. And there are parts of our building in the winter that are almost uninhabitable because they're so hot. You know, I'll see people who have basement offices. I fortunately don't have a basement office, but I'll see people come out of the basement. I say, how's it going? Oh my God, my office is like a sauna. So, you know, even here in this building, you know, sometimes the processes of the building are mysterious. So, last night I came in and I noticed that the room was awfully hot. So I set the thermostat down to 68, but it hasn't really made any difference at all. You know, sometimes I wonder if the thermostat is really attached to anything. It may just be there to comfort us, right? Somebody makes a decision and we pretend we're adjusting it, but you know, I have the feeling that might be true. So even though the thermostat is set to 68, it's about 75 or 76 in here. So it's a little hot. It's a little hot sitting here today. Thermostats are a wonderful thing, you know, because they give us the illusion of control. Not only do the facilities people help us to sit by keeping it quiet around here, but maybe they're also helping us sit by not letting us fall under the illusion of control. So I can set the thermostat, but it has no relation to the actual temperature. And this might be a good thing. This might actually be, I wish it were a little cooler in here. But you know, sometimes when you're not 100% comfortable, you can sit more deeply. You know, when you can control the temperature, and it's not the right temperature, it's hard to get into deep concentration. You know, I don't know if you've ever noticed that, but if you're really looking for the perfect temperature, you know, you can set it to like 72, but then you start sitting and you realize, it's a little too cold. So then you turn it down, it's a little too hot, you know. You could spend a long time fiddling with the thermostat and never be quite right. You know, if you sit down on the cushion and you just say, I don't care what temperature it is, I'm going to go deeply into my breath or deeply into Mu Xin. You know, actually having a little bit of uncomfortable surroundings can make a sitting so deep. You know, this summer we had a August Sesshin, and it was very hot. I mean, it was very hot. And, you know, the word has gotten out that some of these August Sesshins are really hot. And I've heard people say, well, I don't think I'll go to the August Sesshin. It's too hot. But, you know, that's a great pity, because actually people did an incredible job at the August Sesshin. You know, if you sit down in that heat, you really have to go into deep samadhi, deep concentration. And people did it. It was like a dream come true. I mean, for me, as a Zen teacher, people were coming into the Dokusan. It was like a Dokusan room. And just giving me these answers, it's like, wow, this is great. I hope it goes up to 110. You know. So the illusion of control is important. Right? It's important. It helps us to deal with life, you know, with the uncontrollability of life. But at some point, it might not be that effective a strategy. Maybe it's a strategy at some point we really should give up. We really should give up. I have been at Rutgers for 31 years. And I never expected to be doing the job I was doing. You know, I actually got a PhD in literature, and my specialty was like Shakespeare's period, you know. And, when I was in graduate school, when I started graduate school, my graduate director told me that the job market for people with PhDs in English was very bad, and that if I wanted to get a job, I was going to have to be really good. And we all got this speech. We all were told, listen, it's a bad job market. You're going to have to really be good if you want to get a foot in the door. So, you know, people actually did all kinds of things to get their foot in the door. You know, people would try to work with the best professors in the department, the most famous professors in the department. So I remember that there would be graduate students who would almost like audition with these famous professors. They'd go to take their classes, and they'd try to impress them and try to become get them on their committees, their PhD committee. And a lot of people, I think, were actually very strategic about this. You know, they tried to find the most famous professor they could find, and they sometimes studied things that weren't on the top of their list of priorities, because they thought maybe studying with this professor would get them a job. I realized that they were just trying to survive in a difficult situation. But sometimes I felt, you know, that they were trying too hard. You know, but even I, you know, made a lot of decisions like that, trying to prepare for the job market when I got my PhD. You know, but you know, the funny thing is that even if you have a famous professor on your committee who writes letters and calls people all over the country, you can't control the economy. And in the year I got my PhD was actually 1984. And we were in, I think at that time, a rather serious recession. And universities were very much cutting back on all their hiring. And so, you know, in some fields, there were almost no jobs. So a lot of my friends were in the situation of having gone to graduate school for 7 or 8 years and very carefully planning out their careers and making very strategic decisions, like getting the best professor on their committee or studying in an area that would be a trendy area. Taking, you know, doing a PhD on an author who was becoming very popular, very trendy. And everybody had made all of these sort of like little decisions trying to prepare themselves. And then, you know, what actually happened didn't fit anybody's plans. You know, even people who had articles, you know, had published, maybe even people who had book contracts couldn't get a job. And the people who did get a job weren't necessarily, on paper, the strongest job candidates, you know. And it was interesting to see my friends going through so much suffering over this, you know. I had a friend of mine that I just met a few years ago, and I hadn't seen him in like, 30 years. And he was somebody I really admired in graduate school. He was always a very good student. When we would have conversations in the classroom, he would always have something interesting to say. I'll call his name is not Dan, but I'll call him Dan. And Dan was, you know, he was really sharp. He spoke several languages. He had traveled all over the world. He was incredibly well-read. And when he would speak, you know, everybody would listen with respect. And he usually said something very interesting. So I always felt a little bit inferior to Dan. I always felt like he had his act together and I didn't. I went off to my job and he's at a university out west and I ran into him. And he said, "Oh, you know, when you got your job," he said, "everybody in our age group got a job except me. Finally, you know, very bad job market." He said, "You got the job at Rutgers," and he went through all my friends. He got a job at, you know, Pomona, California. He got a job in Oregon. And he said, "I was left in Seattle, you know, and I had no job." He got very deeply depressed. He got a job eventually, and he has a nice life. He's a department chairman, which is not necessarily a nice life. You have a lot of headaches if you do that. But he's a very respected person. But, you know, he felt at the time so terrible. And he felt completely out of control. And we all did. You know, at that time, we had all worked so hard and planned so carefully. You know, we could have gone out on a Sunday afternoon and gone to the street fair. But we stayed home and we worked on our dissertations, right? We could have, you know, gone hiking, you know, for a week in the Okanagan Mountains. But we were in the library going through these old dusty books. It was supposed to pay off, And it didn't, you know. So the academic world is just one world, but there's so many worlds like this, right? There's so many, you know, you can plan and do everything carefully, and it doesn't work out. And, you know, looking back now, 30 years ago, I agonized over every step of the way, you know. So, you know, I worried about whether I would get an article published or not. You know, I would lie in bed and I would worry. I would think, what if I don't get an article published? I won't get a job. You know, and then I'd come to graduate school and I'd run into a friend of mine. He'd say, oh, I just got an article published. It's like, and I was happy for him, but it made me feel bad because I wasn't getting anything published. And then I'd say, where are you publishing? And he'd say, MLQ, which is this very prestigious, MLQ? I can't even get published in, you know, whatever, the Dog Patch newsletter, you know. So, you know, it was, oh my God. And then I'd go home and I'd lie in bed and think, oh, MLQ, and I can't even get published in, you know, Notes and something, you know, Notes on the Renaissance, you know. And I would send something off to a publisher and get a rejection slip. Oh, you know, and I'd meet a friend and she'd say, oh, yes, you know, I've been invited to be on a panel with Stephen Greenblatt. It's this very famous, oh my God, Stephen. You know, he doesn't even know my name, you know. So, you know, I agonized when I look back on it over every moment, you know. Everything was like, you know, on a roller coaster. You know, you're on a roller coaster and it gets to the top and it just drops off. So many moments were like that, just like these terrifying plunges, right? And you know, now looking back on it, I realize how little I actually controlled, you know, actually. I look back on it and I realize, you know, that it was a good thing that I was disciplined. It was a good thing. You know, because when opportunities did come up, I was prepared, you know. I got the job at Rutgers because somebody asked me to send them an article I was working on. If I didn't have an article, I wouldn't have gotten the job at Rutgers. But the thing is, you know, I worried so much about everything. Every little thing was like going off the edge of a roller coaster, or you know, or falling off a cliff, jumping off a cliff. If only I had known how it was all going to turn out, I would have had a lot more fun, you know. You know, I could have said, if only I'd known, you know, when I got my rejection slip from MLQ, I could have said, well, that's okay. Because so-and-so is going to publish me in 3 years, 3 years from now, you know. Or, you know, maybe this conference paper got rejected, but as a matter of fact, in December of 1990, I'll be on a panel in Chicago, right? If only I'd known, I could have relaxed. But it was just like agonizing every step of the way. You know, we all do this, you know, actually. We all do this. But it's, if you think about it, it's crazy. It's a crazy way to live. You know, every event becomes it's like falling off a cliff, right? This is a terrible way to live, and you know, we cling to this illusion that if we're just smart enough, or clever enough, or you know, have enough foresight, we will be able to control our fates. But it's so not true, right? It's so not true. I had no idea 30-some years ago that I would wind up getting this job at Rutgers and that I would hold my job for like 30 years. You know, not a chance. I had a completely different career path in mind. If somebody had asked me, do you think this is going to happen, I would have said, oh, there's no chance of that. I almost didn't apply for the Rutgers job because I didn't think I could get it, you know, because Rutgers has such a good reputation, you know, outside of New Jersey, anyway. So we don't have to live like this. You know, we don't have to live like this. The one thing that got me through all of this was, you know, my sitting practice. You know, when I was living in Seattle, I ran into a Zen monk, Genki Roshi, my first teacher. And I began to sit with him once a week, and it really made a big difference. You know, I would come in and sit down on the cushion, and I would be wound up with anxiety about something. And when I got off the cushion after, say, two sits, I would be a little less wound up, right? And I began to realize, maybe not necessarily consciously, I began to do more zazen because it was like medicine for me. You know, it really lowered my level of anxiety and gave me some breathing room, you know. So I guess I don't necessarily think I sat down and realized, oh, Zen is reducing my level of anxiety. Because I think I was so anxious I didn't know I was anxious. It was just my default position. But I began to do Zen, and I began to feel much better, much better. Zen really helped me, but I would always go through this process. You know, we had a Zen center at one time in South Seattle. So my friend John Sunston, who was a professor of neuroanatomy at the medical school, had a Volkswagen bus, and we would all get up early in the morning, like we'd be out on the street by like 5 o'clock or something, and John would we'd do like a carpool, only we didn't have cars, he did. So he would come by and pick us all up in his Volkswagen bus, and we'd all drive down to the Zen Center in South Seattle in the morning. And I had so many things to do. I would just every night before I would go to bed, I would say, okay, I have to set the alarm clock for 4:30. I have to take a shower, you know, brush my teeth, and John is going to pick me up at 5. And I had so many things to do. I would just think, maybe I'll skip it. You know, maybe I won't go tomorrow. And then I realized, you know, well, he's expecting to pick me up. You know, I'm part of the group. I'll go. And then he would pick me up, and we'd all go down. And as soon as I would sit down on the cushion at the Zen Center, I would have this incredible anxiety. And I would think, why am I here? You know, I have to write my dissertation. I have papers to grade. I've got to prepare this presentation. What am I doing here? You know, and my anxiety would go through the roof. And then, you know, little by little, I'd watch my breath, or I'd work with Mu, and by the end of the three periods, I would feel wonderful, you know. And then we would have a vegetarian breakfast, and then John would drive back to Central Seattle, and I'd get dropped off near Padelford Hall, and I'd go in and teach my classes, and that was my day, you know. So it was wonderful to get free from that anxiety. But I didn't really understand, you know, that the anxiety, you don't have to live with that anxiety. You know, I think that Zen training is really about learning how to give up, you know, to give up on controlling your life, you know, on controlling your life. And this seems like a terrible idea, right? Because so much of our life, it requires control, you know. We have to, if you're a student, you have to be on top of your lessons. You have to make sure you have, I have a calendar too. I used to have a paper calendar, and now I have a computer calendar. And one of the first things I do after I get off the cushion in the morning is look at my calendar and go through all the things I have to do during the day. And sometimes it's a shocking you know, my calendar looks like each of, you know, it's different colors, you know, for different kinds of events. So it's actually quite beautiful, but there's almost no free space sometime, right? And you know, if I miss a meeting, or if I, you know, have to show up for my classes, you know, if I do something like that, you know, that would be a disaster, and I have to be on top of it. You know, when I get to my office in the morning, I have to know just what I'm going to do throughout the day. And, you know, one of the things I do pretty much every couple of days is just go through my calendar and make sure everything is on there that has to be on there, you know. So in a certain way, you know, you do have to be in control of your life. But, you know, if you think about what causes your anxiety, or at least if I think about what causes my anxiety, it's not actually the calendar, right? It's not actually the calendar. It's the mentality, right? You know, it's trying to control things. That's the problem. You know, it's trying to control. You know, when I was at Rutgers for the first couple of years, I was trying to get a tenure. In the academic world, you're hired on probation for 5 years. And at the end of 5 years, you're either made a permanent employee or you're basically fired. They don't call it firing, but that's what happens. So you have 5 years to prove yourself, and at the end of 5 years, you're either going to get a lifetime contract or you're going to be fired. That's how it works. It's a little, I have a friend who works at a law firm, very similar, you know. If you're a junior partner, you have a timetable. And if you're productive enough, you know, at a certain point, you come up for promotion. And they may make you an associate or a partner. And if they don't do those things, they ask you to leave the firm. So you're out. So you know, for those 5 years, you know, every minute that you spend could be productive, you know, could be helping you to keep your job. And so, you know, it's very common for people not to ever take vacations, you know, and lots of people spend sleepless nights as the 5 year point comes, right? Worried about whether they're going to get tenure or not. This is very, you know, this is like, you know, getting up and knowing you might be executed the next day, right? You know, at the end of 5 years, it's going to be the final judgment, you know. And usually, if you don't get tenure, it's not the end of the world, but it seems like the end of the world, right? So, you know, by the time I got to Rutgers, I had done a lot of Zen training, you know. And I made a point of meditating every day, as I always have. Even if it was a very, very busy day, I always felt I owed it to myself to meditate. You know, I'm taking care of many different things. I need to take care of myself. And I sat on the cushion every morning and I would meditate and then I'd go off to this crazy day. You know, and at some point I just realized I can't control any of the things that are necessary for me to be successful here and get tenure. I can't make them happen. You know, I can't make an editor accept something I write. I can't make a conference presentation director choose my paper for the conference. You know, I can't make my students like me, as a matter of fact. You know, if you try to make your students like you, the class can become incredibly unpleasant, right? Because, you know, the students sense your insecurity, you know, and they don't necessarily admire somebody who's so insecure. You know, generally speaking, if you're relaxed and you're interested in what you're talking about, your students will like the course. But the more tense and worried you become, the less likely they are to enjoy the course, actually. You know, so I just realized, thanks to my many years of Zen training, you know, that maybe the best way to approach this is just You know, think of myself as like I'm a passenger, right? I'm a passenger. You know, I'm going on this bus and I don't know where it's going. You know, I just need to be a good passenger. You know, so I just have to get up and teach my class, do my best and teach my class, and I don't know how it's going to turn out, and I'm not in charge. I'm really not in charge. I'm just going to plan the class, go in, give my lecture or do the workshop, and then I'll do my best, and then I'm not in charge, and I'm not going to hold myself responsible for the outcome, right? You know, and actually, this was like a dream. This was like a dream. It made everything so easy. It made my busy schedule so easy. I'm not responsible for the outcome. I'm just going to do my best, and then whatever happens is not in my control. Right? And actually, you know, I began to feel really happy about this very busy schedule because I'm not in charge. I'm just going, in a way, I'm just going through the motions. I just have to be present. I just have to do my job, and how it turns out is not within my control. And that was so liberating for me, you know. It was like magic. It was like magic, you know, because you can't control things, and you aren't responsible for the outcome, and sometimes things happen to you that you never expected, that are the most wonderful thing in the world. So, you know... for example, when I first came here, I was trying to get money for computers. So I wrote computers in writing classes. The computers, this was 30 years ago, so computers were a new thing. Now people would laugh, you know, the idea is so obvious. But back then that was very cutting edge. The idea of using computers in a classroom, that's a very interesting idea. So I had, you know, I wanted to bring computers into the classroom. And nobody at Rutgers was doing it except a couple guys in the economics department. So I kept writing grants, and I couldn't get money for this. People would write me back and say, "We just don't see the point of computers in the classroom." And I, you know, I would spend lots of time on these grants. And I get nowhere. Well, anyway, one day, you know, somebody from the central administration called me in for a meeting, and he said, "You know, we're trying to get people to use computers in the classroom. Is anybody interested?" And I got like $100,000, which at that time was a fair amount of money. And it fell into my lap, you know. And then I built this facility, and it was like a wonderful thing. And it actually did wonders for my reputation at Rutgers. You know, the things I tried to make it happen, and I failed several times, and I sort of gave up, and it fell into my lap. You know, if I had no idea about how to use computers in the classroom, I wouldn't have been able to say, "Please count me in," when we had the meeting. So it helps to be prepared. But I couldn't control it. And the thing that helped so much to make it happen was totally unexpected. So, you know, I think part of Zen practice is everyday meditation. If you don't meditate regularly, nothing is going to happen. But I also think it's important to kind of maintain this spirit that you're on a bus, or it's like there's a flow, and it's flowing, and you're just riding along. It's like this is a river, and you're just riding on the river. You're just on the river. You're just on the journey. And you don't know where it's going, and you're not responsible for where it's going. You're just going to do your best. And that is the most deeply transformative way to approach these problems. You know, this is a part of Zen practice is everyday sitting. But part of Zen practice is making a practice of letting go, of trying, but then letting go, letting go. And usually when we're not letting go, if you look at your own emotional state or you look at your own mind, there's a kind of desperation in your response to things, right? We're often, if you look at your emotional state. You know, there's a kind of desperation in our response to many events, and it's a totally an illusion, but it's very powerful. And so I think we have to make a practice out of letting go. You know, this koan would be a wonderful koan to practice with. If you just said fundamental constant principle, you could just say constant principle, as you go through your day, and just constant principle, you would find that it really helped you. You're not in charge. Don't be in charge. Don't try to be in charge, right? You're just riding along. You're along for the ride. I'm along for the ride. You could also make your koan along for the ride. Along for the ride. This is, I think, a superior way to live. My sister has kids, right? And when my sister had her two, my sister wanted a boy and a girl to begin with, okay? So she was in her 40s, so she had to use special medical techniques to have children. And her first child was a boy, and then she went back to the same clinic, and she said, this time I'd like a girl. And they said, we think we can do that, but it turned out to be two boys. So not what she planned, two boys, not boy and girl. And she's had all of these plans for these kids, right, basically none of them, basically few of them have worked out as she planned. So she thought the older boy was going to be like this and the younger boy was going to be like that. They're totally different from the way she planned. And, she sent the older boy to science camp, but he doesn't like science. The younger boy likes science. In fact, the younger boy gets straight A's in everything. The older boy, it turns out, likes poetry, right? So my sister went through a period, I think, of great frustration where she was trying to be a really good mother. And she was planning everything out, and it was ruining her life. And it was ruining her relationship with her kids. I think now she's become much more relaxed about just enjoying her children, right? And because, when you have, we use this word reproduction, but, when you have kids, it's not, I don't have kids, but from what I can see, you're not, you think you're reproducing yourself, but you're not. My impression is that a kid is like a box you receive, and you open it up, and you don't know what's in there. And it could be anything, right? So one thing you could do is fight with whatever comes out of the box, right? Another possibility is to say, how wonderful, who would have guessed? Who would have guessed that this came out of the box? Who would have guessed that this was my kid? How amazing. I never, I have no interest in science, and yet my kid is fascinated by science, Mike Goller, my colleague, is just like this. He keeps trying to get his son interested in sports. And all his son likes is science, right? And Mike is a literature professor. He's been trying to interest his son in literature too, and that hasn't worked out. But his daughter loves soccer, right? So she's the athlete, right? I think the more you try to control these things, the more unhappy and tense you become. If you say, I'm along for the ride, I'm not controlling this, it becomes this wonderful, wonderful journey. And, when you look back over your life, you realize, how little control you had, And yet, something was moving. Something was flowing. Something's going on here. We don't know what it is, but it's an intriguing process, don't you think? So being open to the process is really important. You know, it's moving. It's something's moving, but we don't know what. You know, even in ourselves, you know, if you do koan training, one of the things that's so interesting about koan training is that you don't even, you can't even control yourself. You know, I mean, naturally we have self-control. You know, if you go to a dinner party, you wait till everybody else eats, right? That would be a good thing. If you have to take a pee in the zendo, you wait until the bathroom break. Right? So yes, you have to control yourself. But actually, you know, when you do Zen practice, you know, and you begin to work with koans, you realize that who you really are is a mystery to you. You know, we have a conscious life and a conscious image of who we are. Yes? But there's another person there. You know, who's in process, right? And we don't know where she's going or what she's up to, right? But we meet her in koan training. It's like we have an image of ourselves based on our attempt to control ourselves. But in koan training, sometimes we realize, oh, there's a stranger in here. You know, there's a stranger. And one way to greet the stranger is with anxiety, and another way is just to say, okay, well, let's see what happens. I'm along for the ride. I'm along for the ride. So your relationship with yourself is also uncertain. You know, you might feel that you know who you are, you know, but actually 10 years from now, you might be a really different person. You might look back on this and not really recognize yourself. You know, and in many ways that would be a really good thing, right? It's something is moving. So you're along for the ride. That's your job, is to be along for the ride. Be a well prepared. If you're going on a voyage, you know, you have to show up every morning with the tour group on time. You don't want to hold things up. You have to have your snacks for the day, you know. You have to have your maps and your guidebook. And then, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. If you don't show up, nothing's going to happen. But if you show up, you still can't control it. And meditation is like that too. You know, when you sit down on the cushion, you may have your own agendas. But they're unlikely to work out. You know, what is going to happen on the cushion is probably much more interesting than what you wanted to have happen. You know, and this is especially true at Sesshin. When people come to Sesshin, you know, they have all kinds of imaginary scenarios. But what really liberates you is not what you expected to have happen, but what you didn't. You know, that's what makes it an interesting journey. So, you know, there's a way of practicing letting go. You know, there's a way of not trying to hold on to things. You just have to try and then be present for the result, you know. It is a little bit like archery, you know. At a certain phase in my life, I really got interested in archery. And I spent hours and hours shooting arrows into a target. And I love, you know, traditional archery. You know, nowadays they make bows that are really like machines. They have levers and springs hidden inside, and they have a weight hanging off the front, and so on and so on. So it's a very high-tech machine, guaranteed to create accuracy. You know, there's a wonderful book, if you ever have a chance to read it, called Zen and the Art of Archery. And you realize the point of archery is not to hit the target. The point of archery is to explore the process, right? You know, hitting the target is the least interesting thing you can do in life, actually. Really. Hitting the target is the least it's the most predictable outcome, right? It's the least interesting thing. But you know, if you're engaged in the process of archery, you know, You have. I love the old traditional wooden bow, because it's not predictable. It's not controllable. It's very temperamental. You know, you have to draw the arrow back. You have to have just the right pressure. If you pull too hard, that's a problem. If you don't pull hard enough, that's a problem. So there's all these variables and uncertainties. You shoot the arrow. You know, and the arrow has its own. It's going where it's going to go. You know, so actually, you know, archery is really about hitting and missing. Hitting and missing. And when the arrow goes someplace you didn't expect, that's interesting. You know, in an archery contest, the only people who take home prizes are the people who hit the target. But in a life, it's not like that. You know, the people who don't hit the target are not always the ones who have the best life. I mean, the people who hit the target are not the ones who have the best life. You know, when you shoot your arrow, you know, you can go see where it lands. You know, you can, I've said this before, but you could paint your bullseye around the arrow. This is a much more creative, this is Zen. This is a much more creative way to live. Much more creative way to live. Zen is all about painting the bullseye around where the arrow lands, being open to the teachings of the arrow, and making wholeness out of the life you have, not the life you wanted. Making wholeness about this life now, not the one you imagined you would have 10 years ago. And the wholeness is always there if you're not crippled by your inability to be present in this moment. Ryutan asks Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? Yanto said, along for the ride. I am along for the ride. Moving. Something is moving. I'm moving with it. That's my job. Ruiyan said, when moving, what then? Yanto said, you don't see the constant fundamental principle. Ryutan stood there thinking. Yanto said, you know, you're not trusting the process. You're not trusting the... Yanto said, you're not trusting the process. Don't think it through. Just be present. Don't try to control. If you agree, you are not free of sense and matter. In other words, if you agree with me, you're worried about the outcome. If you disagree with me, you're worried about the outcome. Be present with the outcome. Verse... The round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem is the best gem, isn't a polished gem. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges, not holding on. Don't hold on. Practice letting go. Try, but let go. Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body resting on nothing, stands out, unique and alive. See? We have a free body, and we wrap it up in chains, you know. That are imaginary chains. And these are the expectations we bring to our life. You know, these expectations are fantasies. We don't know what life is going to be. So when you let go of your chains, when you stop trying to control, and you're along from the ride, you know, you become a free body, a free person. That's like a person who doesn't worry about anything because he knows how the story is going to turn out. You know, it's like if I had known 30 years ago that I was going to get a job at Rutgers, I wouldn't have worried. I would have had a lot more enjoyment in my life. You know, instead I worried every step of the way. we don't have to live that way. You know, trust the process. You're going to wind up where you have to wind up. So be one with where you wind up.